From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rebecca Ward, filling in for Carol Castiel. Joining me on the program is my colleague, Rick Panaleo. He's the host of the science edition of Press Conference USA, as well as the podcast Science in a Minute. Our special guest on this edition of the program, John Butler, a fellow at the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, also simply known as NIST, which is part of the U.S. Department of Commerce. He's a Ph.D. in chemistry and serves as the special assistant to the Director of Forensic Science at NIST, and that is the subject of PCUSA Today, the latest research into forensics, in particular, the role of DNA. DNA research and its use in solving crimes has come a long way since 1995, when it was introduced as evidence in the infamous trial of former American football player O.J. Simpson, who was acquitted of murdering his former wife and her friend Ron Goldman. Back then, DNA technology wasn't as commonly known as it is today, but nowadays, people voluntarily send their DNA to a laboratory to determine their ancestry, which can be traced through hundreds of years to all parts of the globe. But that's just the fun stuff. It really plays an important role in identifying victims and suspects of crime. So, John Butler, in just a little more than 20 years, DNA science has become pretty mainstream. Who can we thank for that, or what can we thank for that?
I think one of the things has been the growth of DNA through databases. So the national database in the United Kingdom actually started in 1995, and that led to at that time was the largest database. The United States started a couple years later in 1998 with the databasing offenders, people that had been put in jail, and then using their DNA to then catch people that committed crimes where there wasn't a suspect in the case. So really the growth of databases has spurred the use of DNA in the forensic DNA community. And then, of course, you've had the ancestry, the direct-to-consumer testing that's happened really since about 2000, where people have started testing their DNA for the purposes of trying to figure out where they're coming from.
John, it's Rick Panaleo, and you got me curious at your first answer, and you mentioned database. What would be in a DNA database?
So a DNA database contains the DNA profile for an individual that's been tested. That profile consists of what, since 1995, when the UK had started the first one, is consisted of what are called short tandem repeats, or STRs. And those are sections of DNA that are just repeated next to each other, very short sequences of DNA. So what you'd have for a profile from somebody would be a series of numbers. It might be a number 8 or number 10 or number 13 that would be recorded as representing the length of DNA at a specific location in the human genome. So typically in the UK when they first started, they had 6 markers that they would test. When the United States started a few years later, because we were a bigger population, we started with 13 markers. And just this year, in 2017, went up to 20 markers so that we would be able to more easily distinguish between people as more samples went into the database.
Well, we have these databases, but there is something, and I think it's fairly new, but maybe you can correct me on that. It's called phenotyping. And what is so fascinating is that it's figuring out who somebody might be.
The characteristics.
The characteristics.
Like.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. From what I've read, it can actually determine eye color from, bits of your DNA.
Right. So the reason that phenotyping has grown of interest recently is because not every sample is in a database, obviously. So if a perpetrator has committed a crime and left some DNA behind, and then a database is searched, even though the database may include millions of profiles, like what we have about 16 million profiles in the U.S. national database right now, but yet there's many crimes that are never solved because without having, there's no hit. So then people would, we have a DNA profile, or we have some DNA that's recorded from the crime scene. What can we do with that? Can we discover more about what that individual may have looked like? And so this is not routinely being done in the United States, but it's been done for research projects. But that's something that's being looked at. And some police agencies have sent samples off to various companies trying to get what somebody may look like from their hair color, or their eye color, or other features.
But I guess the question is, how can they do that? What I found so fascinating is that the cold case from 1992, there was a suspect, but they didn't really have anything to link him to the murder, other than when they finally took this DNA sample and a company profiled this person or gave it characteristics, it looked like one of the suspects, and that's what they used to get a warrant to get his DNA.
In the end, the phenotyping result is not used in court. It's just an investigative tool, so it helps point them in another direction to look further. But the final test would always be the STR profile, the DNA that's tested directly from, once they find somebody they think would be the person that might have done the crime.
When we're doing DNA typing and DNA analysis, what specific identifying information do you look for to determine a profile?
So, like I was mentioning, the short tandem repeats, the STRs, they're links of DNA that are found between genes. So they're found scattered out throughout our human genome. Mm-hmm. And they would be sections of DNA that we can measure how long they are, and they differ between people. And therefore, I may have an 8-10, and you may have a 12-13 or something in terms of the links of the DNA that are being looked at. The reason we would have two is we get one copy from mom and one copy from dad. And so we can, sometimes they're the same length. I may have an 8-8, so 8 from both my mom and my dad. But that's what we're actually looking for in a regular forensic test. With the phenotyping, it's trying to go beyond that and say, what else can we get any features that may be useful from externally visible characteristics like eye color, hair color, or other features that could be of value in terms of what you might see in an individual.
I understand there are different types of DNA.
Well, there's genomic DNA includes nuclear DNA, which is found in the nucleus of our cell. That's where the 23 pairs of chromosomes are located. And then you have mitochondrial DNA that's inherited from your mother that's found in the cytoplasm of the cells. So mitochondrial DNA can be used for, because it's in higher copy number per cell, can be used for bones or hair or other tissues where there's not as much DNA typically in them. So they're used for recovering remains, like in the U.S. military uses them to recover remains from Southeast Asia, from the Vietnam conflict and stuff. They're still identifying people that were lost and using their mitochondrial DNA to tie them into a family member that's alive today.
When we're talking about these databases and we're talking about DNA service provided by services such as Ancestry.com, that's what they look at, the mitochondrial DNA?
No, originally when Ancestry testing first started, which was around 2000, you'd have companies like Oxford Ancestors or Family Tree DNA, and they were looking at the mitochondrial DNA or the Y chromosome. So they were looking at the maternal lineage, what's coming from your mother's side, from the mitochondrial DNA, or they were looking at the Y chromosome, which was coming from your father, the paternal side. More recently, there's been autosomal tests, which what that means is you're looking at scattered tests that are scattered throughout the human genome, and therefore you can look at the mosaic of information that's coming from all of your ancestors. And so you don't have the ability to look as far back, but you have the ability to look at a wider range of potential relatives. And so those tests have been done for most of the last 10 years. There's been an increase in the autosomal, what they call SNP typing or single nucleotide polymorphisms. So those are being done to try to look for a broader range of your relatives instead of just looking at your direct paternal past, like your great grandfather that's your dad's dad, which you could test with a Y chromosome test, and you would have if you're a male. But if you're female, obviously you don't have a Y chromosome. So those are some of the challenges with doing that type of testing. But a big part of the challenge is also people understanding what do the results mean. We send off a sample to a lab, and we get those results back, and then you try to search for relatives from that.
I'm still trying to kind of wrap my head around phenotyping. Rick and I were talking earlier, and we were trying to figure out, well, how can they tell from your DNA that your eye color is blue, for example? But what really I found amazing is the composite sketches of what the phenotyping, the person whose DNA it is, the phenotyping where they have the shape of the face, the color of the hair, and even the claim is even the build of the person. Is that because they are determining that through determining what their heritage or ethnicity is, or the DNA is actually telling them that this person is probably, at least 5'6" tall?
Yeah, we can't predict, like height, for example, is not easily defined with DNA. There's environmental factors and other things that contribute to that. So you can't get every piece of information from a few sites in your DNA test. Whereas like eye color is fairly well defined. The melanin, the pigmentation that you have in your skin, your hair, and your eyes and stuff will impact. There's a few genetic sites you can look at, a few sites in the human genome. And if it's one type, we call those alleles. If it's one allele or one particular sequence there, then that would say you're more likely to have blue eyes than brown eyes, for example. And so that's how they work, is that they look, the computer programs that are being used to assess all this data looks at those specific sites and assigns a probability to those and saying you're more likely to have blue eyes than brown eyes at that specific site if you have this characteristic there. And then if you're looking at some of these other things, in terms of how well or how accurate they are for looking at height or body build or facial shape, that remains to be seen. I think a lot of the computer programs that have been, where I've seen data from, like the ones from Parabon or other places that are trying to do the facial imaging, there's not a lot of things that have been published on that, so we don't really know exactly how they're doing it. So it's possible to predict some of those characteristics more strongly than others.
I was thinking that possibly they were just generically drawing up, let's say if the suspect were of Norwegian ancestry, they could they could draw a composite of somebody typical of that region.
Sure. That's probably what they're doing, but we don't know the details. We haven't, most of those groups have not published anything on what they're doing.
John, I'm curious, what is NIST's role in this technology?
We have the Applied Genetics Group here at NIST that's led by Peter Vallone. I used to be the group leader until a couple of years ago, but there's a group of people here at NIST in the Applied Genetics Group that are looking at the accuracy of some of the calls. So NIST makes reference materials, standard reference materials, which are DNA samples that have been well characterized. So NIST has sequenced those specific sites, and then a laboratory can test those and make sure that their equipment's working properly, that their method is actually yielding the correct measurement at those sites. So that's what NIST has been involved in, is making those reference materials so that laboratories can be correctly calibrated in measurements that are being made for genetic testing.
In other words, in your title, you're setting the standard.
That's the goal, yeah.
Okay.
So phenotyping is more complicated, if you're going to ask about that, because you don't really, it's a lot of interpretations involved. It's not just you measure and at that base it's an A or a T, you know, in terms of the genetic sequence. So, but it is, for measuring the length of the molecule, like what we do for normal forensic testing, like STRs, we can say that's an 8, and we've sequenced that, we've characterized that site very, very carefully.
And so at some point, you will be standardizing what I would call the composite sketch of the
I don't know if we'll ever go that far in terms of being able to do that, but certainly we can say, did the lab test, you know, and get an A nucleotide or a T nucleotide or a C or a G or whatever that site. But in terms of interpreting that to mean this person's definitely going to look like this, that's still the holy grail. We're not there yet.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first a reminder that you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is John Butler, Special Assistant to the Director of Forensic Science at the National Institutes of Standards and Technology just outside Washington. I'm Rebecca Ward, along with my VOA colleague Rick Pantaleo. Our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Kofi Mensah, a listener and Facebook fan from Accra, Ghana. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We'd also like to know what you think of VOA's Press Conference USA and would appreciate it if you took our brief online survey. You can find it on our Facebook page at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on our webpage at voanews.com/PCUSA. And now back to Rick. I believe he was anxious to ask another question of you, John.
John, you talk about developing reference materials to help people calibrate their instruments. What instruments are we talking about? I know, like in genome editing, they have something called CRISPR.
Right. So the instruments that are typically used in forensic laboratories involve capillary electrophoresis, where you have a narrow glass tube and you're separating your DNA molecules based on their length. that's been around for 20 years or more. That's what most forensic laboratories use. Then you have, on the newer technology, you have what's called next-generation sequencing, or massively parallel sequencing, is sometimes called. And there are several instruments that can do that, but you're basically doing millions of reactions simultaneously, and you're sequencing specific, and then with the computers, you're putting all those sequences together and trying to line them up to figure out what's the nucleotide, the base, the DNA base at each position that you're trying to target and look for. So those are the types of instruments that we're trying to make sure the measurements are done correctly on.
I'm curious about the work being done to identify victims of mass murders, such as in Rwanda, Cambodia, and Vietnam. How is DNA being used in those cases of mass murder?
So whenever you have a DNA result, you have to compare it to something else. So you compare it to a family member or to, I helped with the World Trade Center work that was done after the 9/11 attacks here in the United States. So I didn't do any of the testing, but I was part of a review committee that helped with the setting all that up, that was done by the Office of Chief Medical Examiner in New York City. And the way that was actually done is you have to get the results from the crime scene or from the mass murder situation, then have to go back and look for relatives or direct personal effects. So a direct personal effect might be a toothbrush from somebody, and then you can figure out, get the DNA off of the toothbrush, and then be able to compare that back to which of the bones or tissue that's recovered from the crime scene or from the disaster site that then can be linked back to that individual. Or you find a family member, a brother or a father or mother, and then build a link to DNA that way through kinship analysis. So that's what's done, is you have to have, like what they're trying to do in Vietnam, they have hundreds of thousands of samples that they have to get the results off of the bones that they recover, and then they have to try to compare that back to family members. So they would have separate data sets, really databases, that they would compare the profiles between in order to make that determination.
How long does a DNA test like what you're describing, how long would that take? I imagine there are still some people missing from, as we mentioned, Srebrenica, Rwanda, Cambodia,
right,
that are not identified.
Yeah, and some of them probably never will be, because if their entire family is wiped out, that was one of the challenges when the tsunami happened in 2004, that like people in Thailand, they weren't able to identify all the remains because many times entire families were wiped out. So you don't have the ability to look for a child or a mother or father and to be able to make that anchor, that connecting point back to, we know this person now, we have this unknown DNA sample, how do we connect those? So it depends on the size of the situation, what you're trying to deal with, and it also depends on the availability of reference samples and also the quality of the DNA that's being recovered from the evidence site.
We've heard many times, at least here in the United States, about people who have been in prison for a serious crime such as murder or rape being cleared later on due to DNA evidence. How much is DNA relied upon for determining someone's guilt or innocence?
There's thousands of cases that are done every year where DNA is involved. So you have, I think there's around 350 where a post-conviction, someone's been put in jail and then come back later with DNA testing that was not available at the time that they were incarcerated, and then finding there's some evidence that still exists from 25 or 30 years ago that was not available at the time that they were incarcerated, and then finding there's some evidence that still exists from 25 or 30 years ago, doing DNA testing and finding there's a different person's sample on there, and then being able to link that back to someone else that really committed the crime. So then they're let out of prison. So that's happened several hundred times now in the United States.
So I'm taking it that the DNA evidence is more of an advancement from the way they used to test things using merely blood types. So the DNA takes it a step further.
Yeah, you can think of it as a higher resolution microscope where you have only a... With a blood type, you have type A, type O, type mm-hmm. AB, or type B. You only have four choices.
Right.
Where with DNA testing, there's hundreds or thousands of combinations that are possible. And then looking for a random match probability, you can actually, with probabilities, predict it could be millions or billions in terms of the probability of someone else having that same profile.
Is there a point to where DNA is no longer useful? I mean, we've all read about the dinosaur DNA trapped in amber, but is there a point where the DNA from a suspect or a victim is not really applicable?
Well, for the same reason that, like the Jurassic Park example that you gave, over time DNA will degrade and break into smaller pieces. It's a chemical, and it's going to break into pieces when it's exposed to water and heat and other forces that will break the molecule into smaller pieces. As it's broken into smaller pieces, you don't have those chains. You can't measure the whole length. So if originally the site you were interested in had 10 repeats present and the DNA falls apart, you won't get a result at all. And so that happens with older samples and ones that have been highly degraded because of heat or because of water damage and things like that. So those are factors that can cause the DNA to degrade. So you ask, when is it no longer useful? Really two reasons. One would be the sample itself has fallen apart and is degraded beyond the ability to recover something from it. And number two, if you don't have a reference sample to compare it to, when the case we were talking about earlier of the mass disaster situation or the big, like Rwanda, where the millions of people were killed, you don't have the ability to easily compare all of those to be able to make that analysis. Now, I know that there's an International Commission on Missing Persons, the ICMP. They've been doing a lot of work in the former Yugoslavia and identifying close to 100,000 people that are missing, and they've identified about 20,000 of those through using living relatives, connecting them back to the bones that they found in mass graves.
In your work, John, what are some of the oldest DNA samples you've seen that you've been able to get an accurate picture of?
I don't personally do casework. I've done research on things to be able to do things, but certainly there's been publications of even the Neanderthal bones from thousands of years ago, where they've been able to recover the entire genome of the Neanderthal bone that was done a couple years ago. So it is possible to get things that are thousands of years old if the DNA has been sufficiently preserved.
I recently read about the Neanderthals and humans meeting and Europeans. Was that from DNA testing? Is that the kind of...
Yeah, what they do is they model. So they get a DNA sequence from a Neanderthal. They get a DNA sequence from a human, modern human today, and then they'll predict with statistical models what's the likelihood of a certain sequence is being there. And so that's how that's done. They're making assumptions and predicting what's the probability of this occurring, you know, under these various scenarios.
Speaking of DNA samples, what is the optimal organic material to use for DNA testing? Blood, other fluids, skin, bones?
For testing today, all of those things work. It depends on what's available. I guess that's really the situation. So if it's a missing person, that's all you have is skeletal remains, then you just have bone to work with. If it's sexual assault evidence, then you may have semen stain or semen sample from a vaginal swab that might be available. And those things will work if you have sufficient DNA that's not degraded there.
It's so fascinating, but I'm wondering, because we've made such leaps and bounds since 1995, when this kind of came to the average person's attention, where do you see it going? I mean, what more can be done? I mean, obviously, compositing what a person looks like is a pretty big deal for criminology. But where else do you see this going? What other kind of research is going on?
Well, a big part of this going on now is trying to make it faster. So eventually you'll have rapid DNA tests that could be done in a booking station or an embassy where you'd like to be able to know, like, for example, in an embassy, you may have a data set that you want to know, is someone that's coming in asking for a visa, are they really related to the person that you want to allow into a certain country because their family's already there? So DNA testing could allow you to make that connection. With a booking station, typically now people get a mugshot. If they're arrested, they get a fingerprint taken. But the capability exists now to be able to do a DNA test in about an hour and a half in an automated fashion. So you basically take a swab, like a Q-tip inside of the inside cheek of someone's mouth, put that into the instrument, and an hour and a half later it will spit out that series of numbers that are the DNA profile from the various sites that are being tested.
Again, John, you look at the DNA of an individual, and then you need to compare it to a database. And I guess here in the U.S., a big database is the FBI's National DNA Index System, or NDIS.
Right.
Tell us about that.
So So INDIS is maintained by the FBI laboratory. There's about 200 laboratories that are connected to it from around the United States. Those would be labs in Maryland, where I live, or in Virginia, or in California. And they collect data on a local level, on the state level, and then they upload that or submit that to the FBI so that then data can be compared across state borders to be able to catch criminals that may have be committing interstate crime.
And the data comes from criminals that are booked and possibly victims as well?
No, victims are not included.
Okay.
So it's just there's a separate index or a separate database for missing persons that would be victims that way. But the victims from, like, a sexual assault, for example, are not put in the database. It's only the results from an offender, someone that's committed a crime, has been convicted of the crime, that's in jail, or even in some states, someone that's been arrested for a specific crime could have a DNA profile put on the database. And then the other part of that is the forensic section of the database, which is what are the results that are obtained from the crime scene.
Now, you had mentioned earlier in the program about a database in the UK. Are there any other internationally based databases that scientists or crime solvers can rely on to get information from?
Well, actually, we had someone from Interpol visit us, and there are currently 142 countries that use DNA in criminal investigations, and 83 of those countries have a national DNA database. I have very up-to-date data.
Are they networked in a way?
No, they're all individual.
Okay.
So within their country, they may be networked, but we do not have direct connectivity to the UK or anything like that.
As I mentioned earlier, the O.J. Simpson case, the reason that the DNA testimony did not go over so well is because there was contamination of the DNA evidence. And I realize that has actually, because of that one case, has actually changed the way that some law enforcement officials now go into a crime scene. But is there a downside to, from what you can see, is there any downside to DNA testing?
Well, I think one of the things that's a downside is that you expect that it will solve every crime, and that's maybe something that people see from watching on TV. Maybe even police officers believe that sometimes because they've had success with it. And DNA won't work every time because sometimes you get a very complex mixture. As the test becomes more and more sensitive, then only a few cells may be obtained. Well, those few cells may have gotten there by being transferred from someone else. So if I shake hands with somebody, they have a little bit of my DNA on the surface of their hands, and then they touch a knife or they touch a surface of somewhere that might be important for a crime scene. Well, the police come along then and swab that area, and a few of my cells are detected, even though I had nothing to do with that a particular crime scene, that because that there was transfer of my DNA, it could show up there. So that's part of the challenge, is as you get more sensitive with the technique, are the results still relevant? Do they mean anything to the context of the case that you're looking at?
I'm curious about something, John, and that is the technologist, the person actually running the DNA sample. Is it possible that human error could cause a discrepancy?
So the test result itself, like spitting out, there's several places a mistake could be made. Certainly a sample could be switched by somebody by accident in the process of running a whole series of samples. You could put the wrong sample in, and that could lead to two things. You know, you could either have someone missing something that really should be there because it's in the wrong slot, if you will, or you could put a label on something that's not really what you think it is, and therefore you make the idea that, oh, this is now the suspect's profile when it was just a reference sample that was being used to make the comparison. So those are the types of challenges that can happen on that end. But as the sample gets more complex and you have this very, if you have a mixture that has lots of different possibilities, then there's a chance for people to, if they're subjectively looking at that data, to make a mistake there.
Well, thank you so much, John. We have to end on that note. My guest was John Butler, a fellow at the National Institutes of Standards and Technology. He has a PhD in chemistry and serves as the special assistant to the Director of Forensic Science at NIST. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thanks as well to my co-host and colleague at VOA, Rick Pantaleo.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Our engineer was Joe Gill. And of course, much appreciation to our audience for listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.